Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Tara Lynn Massey, author of The Bitter Kind, a flash novelette, co-written by James Claffey and published by Cervena Barva Press.
Book Tales, Reading, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? Well, we thought having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a pretty cozy idea. Today, we're drinking a bitterberry lemonade inspired by Tara's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make one and have it with us.
For those not familiar with Tara's work, in addition to co-authoring The Bitter Kind, Tara Lynn Massey is author of My Real Name is Hannah, Where the Dog Star Never Glows, Stories, and founding series editor for the Best Small Fiction's annual anthology. She is editor of the Rose Metal Press Field Guide to Writing Flash Fiction and a volume entitled The Chalk Circle, Intercultural Prize-Winning Essays. Tara's award-winning fiction, poetry, and prose have been heavily anthologized. She grew up on Long Island's North Shore in East Northport and earned an MA in Writing and Publishing from Emerson College, where she taught multiple college classes. For over 30 years, she has worked in publishing in various roles while publishing her own fiction, poetry, essays, profiles, and articles in venues such as Confrontation, The Caribbean Writer, Hayden's Ferry Review, 5 Points, and others. Her essays have been read on NPR. My Real Name is Hannah, her debut novel, was a National Jewish Book Awards finalist and a winner of a Julia Ward Howe Award. Of the co-written novelette, The Bitter Kind, which we'll hear her read from today, author Kimberly Lojewski says, "From ghost-soaked frontier towns to leafy waterways, frozen river basins, and the open road, Tara Massey's and James Claffey's parallel narratives tumble along through stunning landscapes of loneliness and beauty. The writing is evocative and tender, exploring both the haunted and the haunting, touching in its examination of broken things and masterful in its prose."
The Bitter Kind tells the story of Stella, the daughter of a ship's captain, and Brandy, a boy orphaned early in his life, in alternating flashes between the years of 1942 and 1982. Each character separately battles their own trauma until their lives converge. The Bitter Kind is a powerful blending of narratives and voices as readers follow these characters on their journey of loss and love.
How are you feeling today, Tara?
I'm good and very happy to be here with both of you. Heather, I don't know if you recall, we met at AWP back in Colorado.
Yeah,
I had a really good time with you. So happy to be back again and happy to be meeting Ran online.
Yeah, and it's going to be so fun to hear you talking about your work today. And we are excited to hear you read from your novelette, The Bitter Kind, which was written in collaboration with James Claffey. And I'm looking forward also to hearing you talk about your craft. I know that this is kind of an odd time in the world right now, and it's kind of hard to give live readings, but when you are able to give them, do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do very much enjoy hearing words spoken aloud, whether somebody else is reading or I'm reading them. Mm-hmm. I just think that storytelling basically is oral. It goes back to when we were telling our history and our stories around campfires and fireplaces, and I know that's part of my editing process is to read my own work aloud so that I can hear it. And when I get it right, I love finally publishing something and getting up in front of people and hearing the words spoken out loud. And it's something that I also love about the audiobooks that are being published now. And I'm very happy with the narrator we have for the Bitter Kind series, Scott. I heard a sample. Can't wait to hear the full thing, but it's really something almost magical to hear somebody else reading your work. So it's a little deviation from me reading my own work, but yes, wow. I do enjoy the live readings.
Did you get a chance to hear, is there more than one voice going on with that? When you have professional voice talent, are they doing both the man and the woman in the narrative?
Oh, in this particular book, we have just Siri Scott doing both. And the sample she gave us was the female, but she was so versatile that I could tell that when she got to Brandy that she would do it justice. So we definitely requested her. So I have no issue with that. I do believe that probably saves money. They only have to pay one person, and this is a very small project. So I have no issue with that. I know she's going to do an amazing job.
And it's very common. I know when I was recording a couple of audiobooks in a studio, one of the people who runs the studio was saying how they have voice talent who can do so many different voices, so many different accents, all kinds of stuff like that. So that was pretty fascinating how they were gauging which person they were going to hire for each book and all of that too. And the profiles that they would put up for their own work that they had done also.
Yeah, and there are different narrators, give it a different feel. When I had to make a decision for a narrator on my novel, which had way many more characters, there was one narrator who did try and change her voice for every character. And I actually found it distracting. So we ended up going with one who, you know, she modulated her voice slightly, but I liked her slighter modulation rather than the almost character acting that to me distracted from what was being said. So, but everybody has different tastes and different ways of doing it.
Yeah. And I think maybe a literary audience is going to expect a more sedate reading or something. Could that be a factor? Is the enjoyment of what your taste is?
Probably. Yeah. I would think that certainly along genre lines. They probably hire different narrators.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the idea for where The Bitter Kind originated and kind of how it came to be? I was really excited hearing about this book when we decided to invite you to come on the podcast, because of course I love collaborations and I've done quite a few of them myself, but I'm always interested when one comes to be that's a whole length, like a whole book length work, where it came from. How did that start?
It originated with a short flash fiction story. The Counterexample Poetics that was publishing back about 8 years ago was seeking collaborations. And the editor, James Chang, reached out to me there and I accepted, and then I had to pick a collaborator. So I thought of James Claffey because his writing, while his voice is different from mine, he also tries to pay attention to the lyricism of his writing and is also very in tune to his surroundings and settings and details. So I thought would be a good match. And I had also read a flash piece of his that had the character Stella in it. And I had thought maybe it would be intriguing to have him meet up with one of my characters named Brandy, who was in my collection of title. Well, the title of the collection was Where the Dark Star Never Glows, but the title of the piece was Ghost Dance. And he accepted and we did this little, you know, one page story. And we were surprised to actually get email feedback on it, and a lot of people saying that they wish they had heard more of them and wanted to know more about them and wish it could have been longer. So we discussed it and decided that there was no way that we wanted to commit to a full novel because we both had side projects, but that we'd try a novella. So over the years, we worked on this slash fiction novella, and by the time it got finished, it was still a little short of novella size. And I came across the term novelette, which I don't know how new it is, but I had never heard it before, but it fit our word count better. And I like the sound of it better anyway, too. So we decided to call it Flash Novelette.
How long exactly is a novelette?
I'm no expert, from what I've seen, it's a novella is about 20,000 words minimum, and we were under that at 13,000. But a novelette supposedly is about 8,000 to 20,000. So we fit right into that zone. It was perfect. And it did limit our, you know, querying because of the word count. A lot of places wanted that more novella length, but we did find Trivena Barva Press, which I'm very happy with, who took it. And there were quite a few other places that were also in that word range.
Wow. Yeah, I can believe that, because sometimes when you're trying to find a home for a short story over 7,000 words, that's a little difficult. But then it's also shorter than a novel. So it's not something usually you're going to query an agent with if it's not at least 40,000 words, probably 80,000 for a literary book and 60,000 for a YA, right? So something around there.
Right. My agent passed on the trying to sell the novelette, but once it was sold, she sells audio rights. So she was able to sell the audio rights. So we're very happy with that.
Cool. Okay. Well, that's wonderful. You know, something that I've been very curious about as I was reading this book, because I remember that you and I were in conversation, and I believe you mentioned to me that you wrote the male character Brandy and James wrote Stella, the female character. And I thought that was so interesting because obviously when I read the book, the first time I read it, I was trying to decide, well, how did this collaboration work? Which of these authors was writing which character? Clearly the voices seem distinct, but of course it's your like natural inclination to assume that the man wrote the man and the woman wrote the woman if it's a female, male and female collaboration duo. So I was fascinated to find out that you guys had flipped the switch on that. Can you speak to how you felt creating this reversal and maybe if that led to interesting moments in the conversations about generating the work when the piece was being created?
We knew we were taking a risk. I think both of us are comfortable writing short stories, flashes from the other point of view. I don't think you need to have the full perspective as much when you're writing something that brief because our experiences are not all that different. However, when you are writing anything lengthier than that, you do have to be able to obviously get into that person's mind as much as you can. And so it was a challenge for us, but we wanted to experiment with it and try it out. And we felt pretty confident that we could do it because we were just basically expanding on characters that we already had a strong inclination toward. And we thought it would be kind of fun to see what the reaction might be. So in terms of before it was published or came out and people started reading it, we would help each other out now and then. If I thought he went off base and said something that I did not think a woman would think or feel, I would let him know. And he was very good about fixing it. But there weren't that many. I mean, I think he was pretty spot on. And I don't think he criticized me in terms of textually went off base with the male voice for him outside of some details here and there that he thought I needed to fix. But I think we're both pretty imaginative readers who can empathize with characters. So it wasn't that difficult for us. It was more interesting for us to see what would happen afterwards. I did laugh when someone who reviews a lot of my books wrote to me and said how much she loved. She had only just started reading the book and Stella opens the book. She's like, oh, I love your voice. And I was like, that's actually James Claffey's. And she felt a little embarrassed and she's like, oh, I shouldn't have made that assumption. I can't believe I did that. But I was like, no, I'm glad you did because that was part of the experiment here. Obviously, if people are listening to this podcast, they'll be in on it. But for people who just pick up the book.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that we have been conditioned that way. I mean, I think that also as women writers, it's kind of fascinating because when you want to be very adventurous, a lot of women have chosen pseudonyms that don't demonstrate the femininity of their first name, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
And so it's all the more bold when, if it's just one person and there's no collaboration, when someone does an obvious gender flip on the main character sometimes. But it only sticks out especially much if somebody is not spot on. You know what I mean? Like if there are moments where you're like, I don't know. But no, I didn't feel that. I thought that this book was really well done. But also you and James have, you know, what, collectively 50 years of editing between you or something.
Yes. And we did edit each other at the end when it was complete. We passed the full manuscript to the other person. And so we did edit each other's work.
Yeah. And that's kind of a beautiful alliance when you're doing a collaboration too, to have that much editorial skill gathered in the room, right?
Yeah. You definitely feel like you have an objective, but also empathetic editor right there by your side.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk a bit more about the collaborative process of writing with James Claffey? How much did the two of you talk or share during the drafting process, the revision process?
Well, one of the conditions we made with each other early on was that we would not interfere with each other's timeline whatsoever because we both had so much going on in our personal lives and in our writing lives, professional lives. So this was definitely had to be fun to make it worthwhile, and it had to be done on the side. So there could be large gaps in between waiting for the next person's installment. And that was not an issue. So that's why it did this tiny little book. Basically, maybe it was about 6 years of writing on and off, maybe five to six. And we rarely got on the phone. Now and then we would have to get on the phone to work something out. But for the most part, it was just sending it off, next the installment off in an email and waiting for the next installment to come back. And I just remember being very eager to get see what the, it was a lot of fun to see what would come back. That was the best part of it, I think, was creating something, tossing it over, you know, sort of like a football often, then waiting for the next pass and seeing what that person was going to do with the new pass based on what you, your toss. So it was creative. It was fun. And it wasn't a whole lot of effort.
Absolutely. And over a 6-year period, huh? That's a long kind of wonderful window to get these surprises in your email of the next installments, right?
Yeah, we did work much faster when we got towards the end. You know, you can see that the part one is very long and it's the back history. So that's what took longer. Once we got to when they met up in part two, we wanted the urgent sense of urgency that you feel in that just a matter of hours. So that went much quicker. We were able to toss those back because we were writing paragraphs as opposed to whole sections. So that did go back and forth much quicker.
That makes a lot of sense. So Tara, the idea of ghosts really looms large in this narrative for Brandy's character for me. I know that I've been really interested in ghosts myself and seen a lot of authors writing about ghosts these days. Can you speak to kind of what brought that into this particular narrative?
I think I used the word sort of mystical, mythical early on. I studied the history of witchcraft in college. We had a fabulous professor who specialized in it. And I ended up doing my honors thesis in the connecting Carl Jung theory of the collective unconscious with literature.
Ooh.
And with witches, the anima animus, you know, if you want to get technical in literature.
Right.
So I got to read a lot of wonderful literature that had witches in it. And having studied the history of it, I sort of brought the two together. So now looking back, that was 30 years ago or more, I see the connection of loving history and sort of supernatural, mystical stuff that does arise from our collective unconscious. So it has always interested me, and it crept into my ghost dance story with Brandy because I had gone to Montana and I had visited a cousin out there. And while we were touring Montana, we stopped at a real ghost town and toured that. And my husband at the time, he's now my ex-husband, but we were the only two in this whole ghost town. So it was a very interesting experience to be touring a ghost town and being the only two people there. And I loved it. And I just started thinking, what would it be like to be a caretaker of a ghost town and take care of it and be the only one there? And so that's the genesis of that story. And a ghost does appear in that story. So it naturally got brought into the Bitter Kind. And when I started doing research for the Indians and that part of Montana, I came across there actually was a ghost wolf that when I do get to the reading, you'll hear about it.
Okay.
But there was a white wolf that was called a ghost wolf. So I put that in as well. And that wolf appears in and out of the story. So we knew we were experimenting and throwing in lots of different kind of funky genre things into this novelette. But it was just to have fun. And I've been getting questioned as to, would you put a name to this? Because it's not one thing or another. And I'm like, why do we always have to put a name to something? It just is.
Right.
It's just the Bitter Kind. And it's what we put together. And, you know, do we have to, when you write about ghosts, does it only have to fall into the speculative category?
No.
Why can't it not be? Because people are like, well, but it's very realistic too. And it was like, that's okay, you know, yes, and especially for those of us who may or may not believe in them or are open to believing in them, can coexist side by side.
Yeah, and there is a name for it, and that name for it is literary. I mean, you know, why do people forget this?
Yes.
Do they forget, like, Tristram Shandy? Do they forget these books that have already done these amazing experimental things that weren't all of one piece? Kind of interesting how short the memory of people can be, how little they've read. Right.
Well, and I think it also shows the, unfortunately, the dark shadow of publishing and marketing that hangs over writers' heads. We are constantly told, because that's how they can sell books, especially for literary writers, you've got to fit into some kind of market, which genre writers have no problem with. So where can we put you?
Right.
even as a person of color, as a writer of color, I'm mixed. So nobody ever quite knew and still does not know whether to consider me a person of color and a writer of color. And it's so that's an issue as well.
So do you feel like you would have to be more active in promoting identity as an author in order to have your books shelved where you would like to see them?
Not so much in terms of the shelving, but certainly in terms of the marketing. Having grown up in the United States, I have not picked an identity so much. I mean, I consider myself Indian American on some level, but I'm not entirely. So publishers like to ask me, what ethnicity do you identify with? So I say Indian American, but they look at my writing and I'm not writing about Indian American topics. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for them to then market me into that place. And so it is a harder struggle to get accepted, get published, find an agent, whatever, than it would be if I did write about those topics. But again, going back to that freedom, I don't identify that much with a culture that I would write a whole book on it. Maybe short. I have written some short stories here and there. I also like to experiment with writing from different ethnicities. I don't see why I have to just write about my own. But that has served to keep me from getting published on a bigger scale.
Because they can't put you in a cookie cutter. And yes. So they don't know if you're going to be consistent to keep selling the same type of product for them again.
And even that particular work, yeah. Even if they're not thinking of the future, that particular work, yeah.
Mm. I wanted to talk about the flash writing for a second. I really enjoy reading flash, but I have not written it. And I read, Tara, in an interview where you said flash writers' brains work differently. I wondered if you could expand on that and talk about the transition from writing flash to writing longer prose forms, like a novelette or a novel. Yeah. And do you publish the alternating segments as flash?
Do I publish
the alternating segments as flash?
You mean in this particular novelette? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Did any of the pieces
yes, for
come
sure.
out as flash?
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. We knew we were writing a flash novelette from the very beginning because it started off as a flash story and we wanted to continue. And that's what he especially specializes in. And I love to as well. So we knew from the beginning that we were going to be writing in the flash form. Mm-hmm. When I made that reference to brains, that comes from my experience with working with hundreds, maybe even thousands at this point, flash writers and hearing how they work, how they struggle. And it's not, again, like anything else, it's a generalization. But I have found that many flash writers, their brains do work very differently. They're very comfortable in compression and concision and writing brief, intense formats of writing and struggle to write longer narratives. Mm. And that's definitely a brain thing. Someone who was, trained in sociology and took some courses in neurology and all that. However, there are some authors who can do both, and we all know them. And they probably Stuart Dybeck is a good example of somebody who is actually first and foremost, in some cases, a novelist and a additional short story writer, but looks to flash fiction as a relief from writing those longer pieces. But that, to me, in all the people that I encountered, was more the exception than the rule. Mm-hmm. So for me, yes, I was trained to write this way, and I find I'm very comfortable with it. And I just published some hint fiction. I can write a 2-sentence story much more easily than I can write a 30-page story. And not because it's 30 pages and it's longer, but just because it takes a different kind of mindset and skill set to be able to write and expand on a longer narrative. I just get bored, honestly. I get bored, right? And I have trouble reading books that are too long, dense narrative with pages and pages of dialogue. I get so bored. Mm-hmm. And what was really funny is I had some ARC copies, so I gifted The Bitter Kind to an elderly neighbor who loved my she loved my novel, and she liked my story collection, and she's like devours everything that I'm doing now. And she said, I have to read it. And I kept putting her off and saying, you're not going to like it. So finally I said, you know what? I'm going to give you a copy. I don't want you to buy a copy because you're not going to like this. She's just your average elderly woman who likes to read. And she came up and knocked on my door like 8 in the morning one day. I was still in my bathrobe. She's like, I loved it. She did. I was literally shocked. And she said, I'll use a different word. She said, there's none of that crap in it. She said, I get so bored when people are just talking back and forth and talking back and forth. This just had everything that I needed in it and nothing more.
So, I love that.
So I converted her. She's a fan now. And she's like, I want more. So that's how I read also. I get very bored with literature that just, to me, kind of drones on and takes a long time to get from one place to the other, unless the person is really adept at prose and very lyrical, and then I can enjoy at least some language in terms of getting there.
Do you think that anything has changed in terms of culturally this adaptation to a preference for shorter media? I mean, I remember when I was an undergraduate, everyone was reading these long novels and books and collections, and that at that time, I don't want to date myself, but was when flash fiction started to really kind of get more visibility and maybe take off a little bit more. But I'm wondering if people's attention span has just gotten shorter because of the multimedia that people can absorb in such short formats, or because of the more modern way of disseminating literature. What do you think about that?
Well, my answer to always that is that it's a resurgence, because when I did the historical introduction to the Flash Field Guide, I discovered that this was huge in the late 1800s, early 1900s into the 1950s. And that was a result of people's attention spans supposedly getting shorter because of the Industrial Revolution. And then, yes, I do think it sort of disappeared and it changed and got lost. And with the, I'd say really the cutting edge anthology, Sudden Fiction, is the one that really brought it to the forefront again by Shepard and Thomas. And I think that they were very timely. And I do believe that the computer and online journals did help disseminate this and bring it back again, let's say, into the popular culture. And yes, I do think that reading things on phones and reading things on laptops and computer monitors has definitely shortened the writing again.
I'm really interested to hear you talk a little bit more, if you don't mind, about the historical kind of context for Flash. Is this something where, I mean, I'm familiar with the idea of the episodic pieces that would come out, which would be sequential, like in a newspaper or something of that nature, where you would get little pieces of a story, but actual tiny full stories. How did that look historically, if you're familiar?
Well, they were mostly in periodicals, and Harper's, I believe, Collier's had some. Liberty Magazine is one that I quoted in the introduction. They actually even timed them. And you see that now on some of the current online journals, that if you read this, it'll take you about 4 minutes or something like that. So they actually printed that, you know, they print the short story, you'd see it with a little illustration and say, you know, 4 minute read, 10 minute read, something like that. And they appear just the way they do today. There's no difference, and only a little bit longer. I would say that microfiction is definitely relates to modern times, but the short story, as they called it back then, appeared very much like it does now and was printed very much like it was now. But they got paid a whole lot more than they do now. Believe it or not, writers could actually make a living off of publishing short.
And that's incredible.
And they even appeared in, there were some African American journals that published them as well. And the difference, I would say, is in approach, because, again, that fit more with popular readers. You were marketing it to the general public, as opposed to now that the literary writers have pretty much taken it over to some degree. And O. Henry was a big proponent of it, and a lot of people like to copy him. So the twist ending was something that was done often, and it wasn't a short unless it had a twist ending in a lot of the periods. Mm-hmm. So that's something that, again, that I like, that the modern flash fiction writers have gotten away from that. Not that it's bad to have a twist ending, but they don't rely on that, what I would call a gimmick, as they did in the 1900s.
Yeah, I was teaching Ambrose Bierce and Edgar Allan Poe to my students, and I was talking to them about the surprise ending. Mm-hmm. They were interested to see where it came from.
Yes, I would say O. Henry is the one who started that.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in the use of setting in your book, especially in Brandy's storyline. Mm-hmm. What role does setting play in a story for you, and how do you situate place in the narrative as you're writing?
For me, place is a character as much as the main character is. And when we were off the air, Ran and I were talking about how much we love to travel. And so, you know, my love of traveling, being in different places. I'm definitely someone whose all my senses are very highly my husband would tell you, overly functioning in some cases. So I'm always taking in a lot of different things, and that includes the geography and the setting and the sounds around me. So I try to put that in the writing, and I don't really get excited about a piece of writing unless I'm excited about the setting, and the setting does come either first or in conjunction with the story idea. And I have as much fun creating the setting as I do the character, and they kind of feed off of each other.
That really comes through in your story.
Thank you.
We're really looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from The Bitter Kind today, Tara. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's cocktail is a bitterberry lemonade, and the recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. I've got mine ready, but here are the ingredients so you can get an idea of how delicious it is. We've got raspberries, fresh mint, a little bit of bitters, because we would have to have bitters, bourbon, and lemon juice.
Don't you have some club soda in there?
I did, but I've got the most important things.
Okay. Because I'm drinking some club soda in mine, and I was beginning to think I made it wrong.
No, you did it right. I was just hitting the high point.
It's a fabulous recipe. It's argument. It's very, very, you know, very well done. So I love that. I love that you got the bitter in there too, and the lemonade and the mint, which is in the novelette.
I know. Thanks.
Yeah, it's going to be delicious. I mean, it is delicious. Everyone needs to make one for it or for themselves to have it while we're listening. So Tara, tell us about the excerpt you're sharing today.
Because there are two writers in the book, I'm going to be reading two brief excerpts. Again, Stella is written by James Claffey, and Brandy is my character. And I'm going to read the beginning of when each character is introduced.
Wonderful. Okay, we're ready. Take it away.
Stella. Stella's father was a ship's captain, a drinker, a wanderer of the world, always at sea, exotic port cities, a career suited to the assiduous lifestyle of the hardened drinker. At home in Alabama, in their old-fashioned colonial house 1 month out of every six, he'd roar at her mother and send Stella running for the safety of her bedroom. Her brother sat in the corner of his room, 2 years younger than Stella, and covered his ears with his hand. The Tuscaloosa house was an anomaly for the area, red-bricked, ivory-covered walls and roses and begonias in the garden. Her mother spent hours pruning and digging in the soil, a practice that kept her only just the side of sanity. The walls of the house were covered with old wheels from steamer ships, brass lights from ferries, and huge knots from God knows where. He kept the whiskey in the brass lamp inside the door, hidden by the accumulated years of dust. Nobody was allowed to touch the lamp, and once, when her mother had polished it to a brilliant shine and dusted the glass from the inside too, the captain had clattered Stella's mother on the head with the back of his hand. Times he'd be lovely, though. Saturdays, when he was at home, he'd take her mother dancing at the local Legion Hall, and in his dress blues he looked so handsome. All the other wives oohed and awed over the captain, according to her mom, who always wore her Chanel two-piece and dabbed some mysterious perfume behind each ear and on the inside of each wrist. Those nights, good humor filled the house, and both parents climbed the stairs to bed, giving the illusion of being the happiest of married couples. Once, her mother showed to breakfast with a bruised cheekbone, but she said it had happened when she bent down to take her tights off in the bathroom and caught her face on the sink. Stella dreamed of being 18 so she could leave the house and make a life for herself. The fact she'd have to leave both brother and mother with the captain saddened her. In the dark of her bedroom, her secret world unfolded. There, she made attempts to figure out what exactly was going on in the house during those nights when the captain steered to shore and laid a soft hand on her cheek, whispering to her in the dark. A sea shanty sung damage, and Stella bore the blows in silence. Instead of sails on a yacht, she felt the bottoms of the family coats rustle in the interminable blackness. "Say a word to anyone, and I'll dig a hole and bury you in it," he said. Hands about her arms, his raspy, sour breath on her face. "Nobody would believe you," he went on. His reputation was unimpeachable. Brandy. It is spring during the Great Depression when their neighbor Al Close finally finds the ghost wolf that has been haunting every cattle rancher and sheep herder's farm from the Highwood Mountains to the Little Belts. More than 1,800 cattle and sheep lost to the vicious hunter who melts in and out of the night like a banshee ghost and takes its victims down in its strong jaws, sometimes leaving them partly alive as it flees in its hiding place. Al's red Irish terrier and sheepdog track it down, finally, though no one on horseback or looking out of an airplane has been able to find this menace. His dogs, trained for this moment, know what to do. They break into the sleeping wolf's dreams as it lies curled in the underbrush, and the terrier latches onto its tail, and the sheepdog flushes it out so that Al can admire the huge beast in the moonlight, this larger-than-life wolf whose white fur glows like a fallen star. Just before Al pulls the trigger, he feels a spark of regret. This is a story Brandy grows up hearing on his birthday, because this momentous thing happened on the night he was born. You got some of that spirit wolf in you, his Cree mother likes to say. It left that divine animal and entered you. That's why you're so stubborn. His mother is Judith, named after the mountains she fled to with her white trapper husband. They left the Basin Valley full of crossbreed Chippewas to find gold and sapphires in the rough but accessible lands above. They found little, just small pieces and stones and streams, enough to lay claim to a few acres. Eventually, Brandy's father, Jake Crawford, had to go back to what he knew, hunting and logging. Judith is famous for her pemmican. Brandy often stands by her side, watching her grind the dry buffalo or deer meat and fry the fat. She lets him mix in berries and form the cakes of rich protein for local hunters and Indians who make their difficult way across country. Brandy doesn't know who he is. Indian? White? Wolf? He howls at his mother sometimes, and she throws him bits of jerky in response. He catches them in his mouth and chews, then runs out the door into the patchwork sunlight onto the humus carpet on all fours.
Oh, I loved both of those excerpts. Thank you so much for sharing them with us.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. This was my most fun podcast.
Oh, that's awesome. It's so neat to hear you bringing your work and this work to life. And I enjoyed hearing you read from both sections. So tell us a little bit more about your next project. What do you think you are planning on working on in the next few months?
I already started working on it last year, and I did not think I would be writing about World War II again. World War II is the basis of her first novel, and I have other ideas that I had started, and I was actually starting research on another project, and then someone told me a story, and that's kind of how I work. I'm a very instinctive writer, and I art, you know, just like a dog who got her attention got pulled over to a squirrel. You know, it's like, okay, squirrel, I'm going over in that direction now. So I dropped what I was doing and I started doing research. And again, it's World War II, but it's set in the States this time. And when I started doing the research, I told my mother about it. And it turns out that my grandfather had a small role in it during World War II. So I'm actually, for the first time, she pulled out, I didn't even know we had them, a scrapbook that my grandmother had kept from World War II. And it's full of all this really fun stuff I did not know about from in terms of family history, and then obviously about World War II. So I'm trying to do something again, slightly experimental, and have some of these little beats of history used as kind of relics throughout the book. But I did, again, change course a little bit, and my main character is now a minor character, and my minor character shifted up to my major character. And again, I've learned when writing, again, to follow your instincts, and it was very difficult to give up what I thought the book was supposed to be about and instead go with what the book wants to be about.
The book told you.
Yes.
As it goes.
Yeah.
I have one more question before we wrap up. And that is, what advice would you offer to new writers?
I always tell writers that it's so important to be passionate about what you're doing and driven, and most of all, be able to accept rejection. Rejection is par for the course, especially for literary writers. And you cannot survive in this field if you cannot find a way to cope with rejection. It's just it's constant. It can be overwhelming at times. You can average, you know, one acceptance to 100 queries. And I know some very talented writers who are even better than I am who have dropped out early just because they sent their book to maybe two publishers and didn't get accepted and gave up. And so
really a matter of perseverance.
It's yes. And always enjoying the joy of creation. It beats sometimes the reality of publication. And I'd also say that one of the best pieces of advice I got was from a professor in college who said that you have to develop the skin of an armadillo. And by that, she meant it had to be tough enough to keep out criticism that's not good or hurtful, but tender enough to bring in criticism that's valid.
Oh, that's really good.
And that stayed with me my whole life.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with us at Book Tales today. We really enjoy talking to you and hearing you read from your work.
Yes. And everybody go get Tara's novelette, The Bitter Kind, from Bookshop. And be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks for this podcast series. Subscribe to this podcast too. It releases once a month for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.